So I'd like to welcome to the call our friend Michael McCabe. Hey, welcome, Michael.
Thanks a lot. You can go with Mihu. It's all right. That's hey, it's what God calls me, right? So what the heck, okay?
So you're on, buddy. Welcome yourself to the call. And first, why don't you start with why you got the name Mihu?
Well, when I had the psychic school, I did a lot of talking to God to try to get guidance for the classes. And at one point I asked God, what do you call me? And he said Mihu. And it took me a few times. I wasn't sure I heard it right, and it was always the same. So there it is, Mihu. I think it means like beloved or something like that. It's like a term of endearment or something. So what I hope.
So you had a psychic school?
Yeah, I did, in Boulder, Colorado.
What a great town to have a psychic school.
Yeah, it was good.
The towns to have a psychic school, Boulder would have to be right up there, along with Sedona, Santa Fe,
Iceland.
Santa Cruz.
Right.
Even Austin and Texas would do well with a psychic school.
Yeah. I went to school in Berkeley for the same thing, and that was a great town. They welcome psychic stuff in Berkeley.
So
tell us a bit about that psychic school. What did you do and what did you teach there?
Mostly healing. I taught medical clairvoyance, kinesiology, hands-on healing, you know, aura healing. A lot about the actual structure of the subtle bodies and that sort of stuff.
Cool.
So how did you run across Ormus?
Well, a friend of mine, I was feeling old, sort of there. I'm getting pretty old. And I was feeling old, and I, you know, really hoped I could find something that would help me. And a friend told me about it. I scoffed at it. I went, oh, you know, you got to be kidding. You know, he's going on, oh, it turns the clock back and yada, yada, yada. I'm like, oh, come on. I can't do that. Okay, I'll try it just to show you're wrong.
And did you show him?
No. It's what true believers are made out of. They're made out of skeptics, you know. Because once a skeptic is convinced, they're the absolute worst fanatics. I'm a fanatic.
now, don't you have a degree in physics?
Yeah, I sure do.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh yeah. Well, I do believe that science is a religion, as I've said, you know, and I think the real advanced sciences were religious. You know, we read about them, you know, in the old stuff from Egypt and all.
Uh-huh.
But do you have any proof?
So what was the question?
You have a degree.
My question is about this whole idea of science being a religion. Do you have any proof for that?
Mostly the studies that have been done on double blind tests that show that there's an influence going on, even when the experimenter's double blind, then it's like the reality of the experimenter comes through whether the experimenter wants it to or not, or is blind to it or not. So
yeah, I know, and you never got that was actually a joke.
Well, there is some proof because people have studied that kind of stuff. Thanks, I need a comic relief.
I think that was his point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sorry, I have a bit of an unauthorized sense of humor sometimes.
Yeah, no, that's good. I could tend to be too serious on this call. I'll try not to.
Yeah, well, you know that you know what they say about angels? That angels fly because they take themselves lightly.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So we were talking about your psychic school and how you got into Ormus. And so what was your first beginning of the Ormus journey, and what was the result, and what happened?
I heard about it, and I got some, and I got a hold of a couple, some ZP Tech stuff, and I also got some stuff from the people that make the Ethereum gold. And I was taking that, and I was pointed to Barry's site, and I read the stuff that says, well, you should measure yourself first, and I did. 3 weeks later, I measured myself again, and I had gained an inch in height of
really?
What I lost. Yeah. It shocked me. I mean, I was like, I was so completely floored, I couldn't even believe it.
Did you feel taller?
I didn't hear you. What did you say?
Did you feel taller?
Yeah. Oh, I did. I did. A towering giant. No, a little bit, yeah.
How old are you?
I'm 59, just a few months shy of 60.
Ah, you're just a little bit younger than I am.
Yeah, I've got spinal curvature, and I've lost 3 inches in height.
Uh-huh.
So I have lost 3 inches. Now I'm down only about an inch and a half. So.
Really? So that gained an extra half inch as well as the first inch.
Yeah, I got another half inch out of it. Yeah, that other half inch took several months, three more months.
Wow.
But yeah, I was.
But you'd be a fan of that old Nat King Cole song, that Straighten Up and Fly Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And so was that your main reason for having Ormus, or was that just a little benefit along the way?
That was just a benefit. My main reason was I was feeling old and slow, and I was feeling old beyond my years, I suppose. I've had a lot of falling injuries. I've fallen a number of times. One fall was 34 feet, and I'm not disabled, but I sure felt creaky. And I feel like 20 now. I feel unbelievably good, and the Ormus has really, really helped.
So you're looking forward to being a sexagenarian?
Yeah, fairly soon. It's December. I'm a Sag.
Well, you can't help that.
Yeah, I know. It's too bad, but it's my lot.
So I've always noticed that Sag people are particularly the enthusiasts of the zodiac. They can't help themselves. They're almost unalterably, uncontrollably enthusiastic in their outcomes and their outlook.
Yeah, well, I wish it was completely true. No, I used to be that when I was young, but that was, hey, you know, what they say about being reserved for the young.
Well, now it sounds like you're getting
so
hurt there again.
I'm sort of a curmudgeon, a grump.
Doesn't sound that way.
So one of the things that I discovered with talking to Michael and on our pre-call couple of calls is that Michael started investigating what you might call the occult or the subtle realms or the realms of consciousness, because the word occult means hidden. And Michael starts exploring some of the hidden aspects of consciousness by doing hypnotic inductions, because his mother was a professional hypnotherapist, when he was 12 years old. At 12.
Wow.
So, Michael, tell us a bit about that.
Yeah. I picked up a book that told how to do it, and, you know, the first fascination is getting to do it, you know, acting like a chicken.
What's the name of the book and by whom?
It was by Melvin Powers, and it was called The Power of Hypnosis. And so right away, we're pretty much, me and the kids in the neighborhood were doing this, and we got bored with acting like a chicken and, you know, that sort of thing. Went, hey, let's check out past lives. And that was it.
Wow.
We started doing that really early.
So checking out past lives, I mean, was that also fascinating for the other kids, or was it something that just was a particularly strong bent for you?
I think my fascination was more than anybody else in the group. So I may have carried the group in that way. I drummed everyone up. I was real enthused about it.
I used to do that too.
Yeah?
Yeah. One thing I noticed was that most people who don't believe in reincarnation didn't in their last lifetime either.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I probably hypnotized something like 80 people in the late 60s, early 70s, and so on.
Yeah.
So
I was telling Michael that I used to hypnotize my friends when I was about 17, and because I grew up in New Zealand and had some very big Maori mates who are sort of natural-born warriors and pretty fearsome-looking guys, I hypnotized a couple of them, and I wanted to test the strength of my trance, see if they weren't just playing along. So I put down a saucer of milk, and I had them drink milk out of the saucer. I figured if they drink milk out of the saucer, they were really entranced.
Oh, yeah.
And this one guy came out I told him he wouldn't remember, and he came out and he couldn't remember, but he was as angry as hell. So I had to put him back into trance and tell him he'd come out, and he would remember this time, but he wouldn't be angry because he'd understood I was just testing my trance.
Uh-huh.
Well, it kind of like saved our friendship.
So Michael,
it's such fascinating material. So Michael, how did you tap into past lives that were alchemical?
I started in the early 70s. I started looking at those lifetimes. And I didn't really get to the Egyptian stuff until I started getting interested in it in more of the 80s. I mean, I'd looked at my fascination was first about magic, about the really old lifetimes that were magical. They were called Garden of Eden. But in the 80s, I started recovering memories from the Egyptian times and Moses and it was snippet.
How did you do that? Were you hypnotizing yourself or somebody else hypnotizing you?
Well, in that particular thing, that was when I was going to the Psychic Institute in Berkeley.
Uh-huh.
And they would direct you. Part of the clairvoyant program there was to pick up, really rapidly pick up past lives and that sort of thing. And they would direct us. And one of the things they did, which was really fun, is they would say, okay, you're going to get, you know, a surprising lifetime now. And you'd just like, ooh, all of a sudden it'd come to you. And the big surprise for me was remembering being in a group of people and they looked like Egyptians, and some of them had the garb that looked like either Phoenicians or Israeli people, you know, with the robe and that.
Uh-huh.
And remembering all being around in a circle and the person in the center disappearing in intense gold light, like a fire, and then reappearing. And
wow.
I'm pretty sure that's the Ormus. I mean, that's the end state. That's what was going on, I believe.
Uh-huh.
Why did you come to that conclusion?
That's more of a feeling. If you could do something like that, you'd be convinced, hey, I must be an avatar, you know, because I remembered myself doing it too. But I'm not convinced I'm an avatar. I really felt like there was something that I had that was helping me to do that. And I really think that was in state materials.
About the circle of people coming and going, how did you associate that with end state?
I didn't at first. I mean, it took me, I had to get to finding out about Ormus, and as soon as it sunk in that it could really change things, I went, aha, this is what was going on. I knew there was something, but it just sat for 20 years, you know, brewing in me, like, what the heck was that? You know how that is, where you go, hey, I did that, but, wow, I wonder how we did it. I didn't know. So I didn't, you know, back then in the 80s, I didn't know it was in state. I knew it was something, but finally, you know, I connected it before I read the arc. You know, the stuff about the arc.
So, Michael / Mihu, when you started having these dreams about people being in a circle and people disappearing and reappearing in a golden light, that's what you said, right?
Right, right.
Now, did you have any recollection of which kind of culture that was in?
Oh, yeah, I knew it was Egyptian because I looked, my own body was that of an Egyptian priest or either priest or royalty, like totally shaved except for a couple of knots of hair and stuff like that. and you know, pieces of gold and stuff like, and you know, gold things, you know, I don't know, you know, adornment in gold, like a gold plate they give your shoulders. I don't know what you call that.
So therefore, did you conclude that you were an elevated priest of some kind?
Yeah, I think that when I remembered the first one, you know, I think I might have been Phineas. You know who Phineas is?
No.
Phineas is Moses' right-hand man.
Ah.
It's sort of Moses' shadow is what I'd call it. His shadow.
Right. So, in other words, it was when the Israelites were still in Egypt, and the circle would have been a combination of Israelites and Egyptians
right.
doing something together.
Right. Yeah, that's surprising. Yeah. I've never read anything like that in history, but just recently I went back through the Ark book, and he mentions that you know, that Moses was an Egyptian, and some of the Egyptian priesthood went with Moses, and so on. He had his parts of his family that went with him, and I think I was part of the Egyptian priesthood that went with Moses.
Wow. Now, you mentioned, or Dennis mentions, that you had another past life as well that you remembered?
Yeah, you mean, I remember lots. Which one? In that area, or?
Well, just that seemed to be related.
Let's see. That one was...
What you can do is cut to the lifetimes that you have any memory of anything Ormus.
Right.
Or M-State related.
Right. That lifetime was huge. Boy, that was the big lifetime for Ormus. And it seems like we also stirred the pot a whole lot. Oh, one of the things that's really neat is that I think there were two arcs. That's something interesting.
Two arcs?
I missed that sentence. Would you repeat that? Because it wasn't clear to me what you just said.
I said, the thing that I think is really interesting is I believe there was two arcs.
There were two arcs. Okay.
Right. Right. You know how in the secret, you know, Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark, he says that there's only one arc, but I remember seeing two. I remember two. And
were they identical?
The carrying cases, what I remember is seeing the ark in a big, like a protective case, I think is what it was. I think it was like a rubberized, almost like big thick foam rubber deal. And well, that makes sense. I mean, it would still charge up under rubber, and it would be a lot less lethal. And so I'm pretty sure we carried it, and the ark, as I remember it, in its case, the two of them looked the same from the cases, but if you took the case off, they were different then.
Did you notice any or recall any correlation between the ark and the possibility that some of the Ormus was in it?
Yeah, I believe that Ormus was in it. I don't remember the process in the way he described it, where it was like an arc, like an electrical arc. I don't remember it that way. I remember it as if the what was happening down inside the box was like real energetic. It like it really did something down inside that box. And there was I do remember it was like a pot. I think the pot was made out of gold too.
Okay, let me just interrupt at the moment, and just for the few people who have just come on, would you please hit *6 so the background noise does not come through to the call. Hit *6 now, please. Carry on, Michael.
Yeah, there was a pot, and I believe that we took the white powder of gold out of the pot, and then made a preparation that was put into this other arc. And the other arc was the same dimensions, but it's like the mana machine that the guy talked about in the mana machine book. I haven't read that book, but it explains, you know, what was going on. It made something for us to eat, I think.
Oh, wow.
We didn't eat very much of the stuff. It fed, you know, thousands.
So what you're saying is there was one of the arcs that carried something that fed thousands? How did that work?
It grew. I believe it was like a blue-green algae, and I think we mixed the blue-green algae with different things, you know, to make make mana to eat.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not real clear on what we mixed with what. That's a matter for further exploration. But now
you're exploring a lot of new ways of making things and working with the elements. Are there any correlations between what you're exploring now? Do you feel like you're remembering techniques that may have been from the past?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Could you describe some of those?
Yeah, like adding the ormus as you brew wine.
Uh-huh.
I think it's just like, it's an odd thing. I think if you make an environment for ormus, it multiplies. I mean, it for some reason, as it grows in a plant or in a bacteria or in a yeast, that action while the yeast, for example, grows, makes a really potent form of ormus.
Sort of like what the physicists call a strange attract.
Yeah, exactly. It's harnessing force of nature. Exactly.
How do you make that your wine ormus now, Michael?
Well, I take a 5-gallon pail of must. And must is, it's squashed grapes that are not, it hasn't been sterilized. So it's just the grapes without any processing. And I add the ormus to it, and I just allow it to ferment naturally.
How much?
And what kind of ormus do you add to it?
What's that?
What kind of ormus?
Oh, I only add maybe a tablespoon to the whole 5 gallons.
Cool. But what kind of ormus?
Oh, my morning dew ormus, which is made from Dead Sea salt, and using that salt to capture morning dew, and then diluting it with trap water, and then doing the wet method, and then using trap water to wash with.
Now, have you collected the morning dew in Canada and Arizona?
Uh-huh.
And do you notice any differences?
I do believe that the stuff up here in Canada is better.
You probably have more opportunity for dew with moisture air there, right?
Right, exactly, yeah. So there's a lot more dew in the air. And sometimes it's real misty here. So I just get a ton of dew. Yeah. So I add that little bit of ormus to the wine and let it ferment for 30 to 45 days. And what I'm finding is that after it's done, after 45 days, that ormus start multiplying in the wine. There's like little bits of ormus floating all through the wine. I mean, it's...
Now, how are you defining ormus? Are you defining it as a precipitate or as a transcendent substance?
This seems to be as if I had added maybe a cup of white precipitant, and then it just kind of stayed in there. So in other words, instead of it being like a tablespoon, like what I put in there, there's many tablespoons coming out of each gallon. It seems like in that environment, that ormus is replicating itself or something like that. It's actually growing.
Wow.
How fascinating. One of the things that I've noticed, by the way, is ormus loves a crystalline matrix. And it was Don Nance who first put me onto that, which was about the third conference call we had about 2.5 years ago, and he mentioned that Ormus loves a crystalline matrix, which is both sugar or salt. And it sounds like that possibly that the sugar is being recruited as a and is being turned into precipitate. Do you think that's what's happening?
Yeah, I think so. It also seems that plants, there's something about growth that actually seems to open up something to the Ormus. So there's like some sort of symbiotic relationship between the Ormus and whatever's growing. So, I mean, it's actually, yeah. I mean, certainly the structure, you know, of the, it probably is growing, you know, on the crystalline structure of whatever's available there, the sugar or whatever.
Now, are you noticing any change in how long it takes to do the process, the winemaking
process? With the wine?
Uh-huh.
I've only done 2 batches, so I haven't noticed, you know.
It seems to take about the same amount of time as ordinarily.
Well, yeah. What I've noticed is that when I added the Ormus, the amount of, you know, the wine bubbles as it's fermenting. And usually the bubbling is just like a subtle thing. It's just bubbling slowly and it's not a big deal. Uh-huh. And when I added the Ormus to the very first batch, I was blown away. About 3 days later, I lifted the lid and it was like full of foam. It had bubbled so much that it filled the whole cavity above the bucket with foam.
Wow.
It's like, woohoo! Whoa!
And how did it taste?
It tastes way, it's different than regular red wine, and I only do red wine. The way it's different is that it tastes smoother. It's obviously higher in alcohol, but it doesn't drag you down. You don't get that. You don't get as much of a relaxation thing from Ormus wine. It's sort of like you have a sense of like Ormus gives you. You know, well, about like taking a dose of Ormus, having a glass of wine.
It energizes you.
It energizes you. Yep. Yeah. Pretty cool.
And
that sounds very cool. Now, how much? Like, if there are some people on this call who wanted to exchange some of their money for some of your Ormus wine, how much would you sell it for?
You know, unfortunately, I can't do it. I can't sell it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I wish, but I'd have to get all kinds of licensing and stuff in order to sell it. So,
okay.
I'm absolutely glad to share the method of making it.
If someone were to show up at your place, you could maybe share a little bit with it, eh?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
There you are. There's always that here. We'd have a good discussion about Ormus and wine.
Well, Dennis?
Yes, Mike?
I got another question about taste. You said it's smoother. Does it taste sweeter or can you give me anything more about how it tastes than just smoother?
Yeah, I really think that it's less acidic. You know how red wine has that real acidic tartiness?
I believe that
it's brought the acidic down. That it's not, it doesn't have as many as much. I guess it's tannins in it to make it acidic. So it still is red wine, and it tastes like red wine. I mean, it tastes really good. I'm completely sold on it. But it's a lot smoother.
It still has the fruity taste.
Yeah, the thing I like about it is that it makes it so you can taste a lot of those more subtle tastes because it seems to bring some of that sharpness down. It's like it's mellowed the wine.
So it doesn't shut off your taste buds with too much acid.
Right, exactly, yeah. Yeah, pretty cool.
Great.
Now, Mihu, what I'd like to ask you about, and we're coming up to a question time's going to start for the free room, But what I'd like you to address for a few moments while Barry runs as a random generator to find out who's won a couple of your remarkable Ormus products, which are astrologically tuned to the people who are going to get them, would you tell us a little bit about the kind of Ormus products that you do sell?
Yeah, I have my website, which is www.MotherEarthAlchemy.com.
That's Mother Earth Alchemy?
Yeah, MotherEarthAlchemy.com.
Would you please put the link to that on the Ormus forums?
Yeah, sure will. I make Morning Dew Ormus. A couple times a year I make the Killer Grape Ormus. I make Salt Scrub. I make Ormus oil that I age for like 6 months.
Did you say Ormus oil?
Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. I extract. I use organic oils and
what kind?
Olive oil, sesame oil. Sometimes, and it depends on what I'm going to make it for. Sometimes I use coconut oil in there. Some people prefer it without coconut oil, so the batches I have right now don't have coconut oil in them. And I take Dead Sea salt and I put it in a container and I agitate it once in a while and I age it for about 6 months and then it's ready. And
just like that?
Just like that, yep. It's a simple one, but it really works.
And what do people use that for? Me who?
Salad dressing. Ormus oil seems to close up lesions. So it's a great topical oil. So like if you've got a hardening of your skin or something, you know how people get, especially old folks, it works really good for that. And also if you want to consume oil, a lot of people need oil for their diets. Ormus oil is the best to use for that. And Ormus oil doesn't give you the intense release that taking like what precipitate does. It gives you a real slow, strong Ormus. That's what I find anyway. It's like slow and strong.
What effects? People use it as massage oil, right?
Yeah.
And how does that work differently for people?
You know, a lot of times people will get a rush after being massaged with Ormus. Oh, well, of course.
Uh-huh.
They'll get like this you know, vibrant rush, like a kundalini rush.
Okay.
I think the most I've noticed is with the salt scrub. I make an oil salt scrub.
Uh-huh.
That I essentially do the same thing, but then you just get, you're getting a Dead Sea salt with oil in it. It's been aged 6 months. And the salt scrub, if you go in, you scrub yourself down with salt and go in a hot bath, oh, man, the rush you get is, it's like ascending or something. It's just like the most heated, cool, wow. It's really cool.
I've also noticed that as well, giving people massages or getting massage with it, the oil. Definitely, okay. Cool.
Yeah, I should.
So, Michael, when you talked about the rush of having being scrubbed down and then having a hot bath, when you say the rush, what specifically do you mean? What kind of a sensation are you calling a rush?
Like a lot of vital feelings, maybe mixed with heat. Sometimes heat, you know, like kundalini rush is what I'd call it. More like, like vitality's pouring out, you know, your ears, vitality pouring out down your arms and out your hands, really nicely warm legs and feet, like that.
Wow.
Like your body feels, vital, like you just, you know, like you just had a good, you know, massage or something, you know, something like that. Like a real good vital feeling.
Cool.
Yeah.
Have you ever experimented with doing this on the new moons and the full moons at these peak power times?
Actually, no, because I'm usually making ornaments a day. But sometime or other, I will have to, though. That's a good idea.
One of the things that you can do is after you've made your ornaments on these peak power times, sometimes that might be 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning for me, I will have a full moon ormus bath, and it gets me so out there that I then stagger to bed and collapse and wake up like 12 hours later going, what happened? It puts me into such a deep state, like a transcendent state, that it seems to elevate my soul and significantly advance my evolution as a being. Is that what you're calling a rush?
Yep, that's what I'd call a rush.
It's
like vitality everywhere. Exactly. It's the rush, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So
what I'd like to do before you go on is to invite any questions from the free room, because we're going to be running out of time for the free room shortly. So any questions from the free room before you guys get cut off, and hit *7 to unmute yourself.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi, who's that?
Can you hear me? My name is Anthony from New York.
Hi, Anthony from New York.
Hi. Listen, I was just curious. So after you make your wine product, and do you enjoy it with dinner? Do you have a glass of wine? Do you, like, how much of it do you drink, and how much is too much? What's the dosage?
I have a couple of glasses
for wine.
I drink a couple of small glasses, the little wine glasses. It's probably, I probably drink eight ounces of wine a night. Some nights I only have one, but yeah, I drink it, I have it with dinner, exactly, yeah.
Okay. One of the thoughts I had was, while you were talking about this whole process, I'm sure that the microbial, fermentation for 45 days is, really amping it up. But I'm just wondering if, on a smaller scale, if one didn't open a bottle of wine and put some ormus in there and shake that up for an amount of time, if that wouldn't potentiate ormus as well, as maybe an even sort of more miniature, simple method. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I tried that a long time ago, a couple years ago, and it just ruined my wine. That's all it did. Yeah, it was bad. It was bad news.
So it has to do with the growth, the yeast growing the ormus. It likes that.
Right, exactly.
Wow. Okay. That would make sense with the blue-green algae, too, that you were talking about. If blue-green algae was growing with ormus.
Yeah. That's my next experiment, is I'm going to buy an aquarium, and I just haven't figured out how I can heat it without electricity. I'm not sure what I'll do to make that work,
And it's interesting, too, because they're talking about making fuels out of algae now instead of ethanol.
It's
interesting how all this stuff is sort of, what if they added ormus to the fuel?
And not just alcohol fuel, but also biodiesel.
Interesting.
Thanks.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions from the free room? Speak up now. Forever hold your peace. Hit *7 to unmute yourself. Quickly.
You still got a few more minutes.
Okay. That opportunity went begging.
Tell us a little bit about the alcohol level. You say that you feel like you've gotten about twice as much alcohol in a given amount.
Yeah.
Wow.
I've been adding I've been testing at the end of it to see if the batch is done, and you usually use a densitometer to see if it's done. And after a month and a half or 2 months, usually the densitometer, the place it reads at is right on the line or right in the middle of the line of what they pre-measure. The densitometer is all set up and lets you know if it's done.
The densitometer is designed for conventional winemaking, not for, let's say, making Burgundy or something, right?
Yeah.
So it may not actually accurately measure that high a level of alcohol.
Right. What it is measuring is the density of the liquid.
Uh-huh.
It tells you, so the more alcohol it has, the less dense it is.
Yes.
So the densitometer sinks deeper when there's more alcohol. And I was pretty shocked by where it wound up on the, you know, it was like, whoa, you know.
Can you get, if it's a winemaking densitometer, then it would be calibrated so that that would be off scale.
Yeah.
But if it were a, let's say, a hard liquor densitometer,
right,
it might have a calibration. Do you know if they make such things?
They probably do. I haven't investigated that. That's a good idea. I think I should look for it.
Yeah.
I just did an evaporation test. And I know you get a little water that comes off with the alcohol, but it's probably fairly close, within a few percent probably. It depends on how rapid you make the boiling. If you make it a really rapid boiling, but I used a gentle heat in doing to boil it off, and it was the volume decreased. I'd say it was 27% is what the volume decreased by.
Uh-huh.
Hey, Barry, would you please run your random number generator before the free room has disappeared so we can announce the winners for the raffle?
Already done.
Oh, fabulous.
And the winners are Roger in the UK and Hazamina.
Hazamina?
Uh-huh.
From Australia?
I'm not absolutely sure, but I think so.
Cool.
And these guys will get in touch with me to give me their details on the custom ornaments, right?
Yeah.
Well, some emails will be going to those folks, and they'll get hold of you by email.
Okay.
Because they're gonna have to send you their astrological details so you can do their chart and make an ornament specifically for them. Isn't that true?
Yep, that's right. That's how I do it.
Cool.
It's pretty surprising that the ornament so follows the moon that the different aspects really will show up in a kinesiology test. Just amazing. I mean, like when I test different people, the difference is pretty sharp. It's real strong.
So what do you do to make it different?
Well, I have all the different ormus made under each sign of the zodiac.
Oh, I see.
And when I'm making the ormus, I try to look for, you know, positive aspects. So, you know, stuff that's like trine or conjunctions or that sort of stuff. I try to steer away from, you know, from aspects that are square.
Uh-huh.
And so what I'll do is I make the ormus. I've got all these different signs of zodiac ornaments. And so when I make it up custom, I look at the chart and I see where the chart seems lacking, and I add it there.
Wow.
So I'll do stuff like I'll add ornaments for the north node, you know, like that. I'll maybe add, you know, their ascendant ornaments from their ascendant. You know, like that. Or if there's something that they have a complaint, like, you know.
Right.
Like, I can't talk to people.
Uh-huh.
Now, for those of you guys who are not astrologically fluent, and that includes most of you, the ascendant is what's on the horizon the moment you're born, and the north and south nodes tend to indicate your careers and your destiny as a being this lifetime. And the aspects are the angles in which the planets in your chart relate to each other, and squares are 90-degree angles and 45-degree multiples, and they are hard. And so what Mihi was talking about is making an ormus that harmonizes with your chart and brings out all the best stuff in your chart and accentuates all the good things in your chart to make them even better. Is that what you're saying, mate?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, it can actually fix the code in your node.
Yeah.
I've always wanted my node code fixed.
Yeah, I've got a big lump on mine. I just kidding. I wonder if the ordnance can fix that.
I don't know.
I always wanted to go down that code node road.
So
that's great about those two winners, and I'm sure they'll be pleased. They're probably not on the call, but the thing is that if people aren't on the call, it doesn't matter. They still win.
Right,
they're still going to get the whoopee-doo news.
Yeah.
So one of the other subjects that I know I'd like to explore with you, Mihu, is why you think Ormus is female. How did you get to that?
Well, mostly by the way it feels in my field. You know, it seems to make me and most people that I've talked to more emotional. And, of course, the emotions are the female side of us. And so I believe that that's why imprinting works so well, that it's female, so you can give it stuff to hold. And you're sort of passing on the stuff that you've given the Ormus by imprinting it. So
what I've noticed is that it makes me feel more receptive, more allowing, and less assertive. So often we think that the way to get what we want is to make an assertion, to assert things. Well, that's a good way to start, but then at some point, you have to let it in. And the Ormus seems to help let it in. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, exactly. That is the yin for the female aspect, what I would call it.
Yeah.
And I notice when I look down at the chakras, and I look at the backside of my chakras,
uh-huh,
where the Ormus, when I've had a good dose of Ormus,
yeah,
it gets a lot more, it feels more like a material solid almost. I mean, it's not really solid, but it has that feeling more. It's like it strengthened it, is a good word.
Mm-hmm.
And it also seems to strengthen all the connections between the chakras. It really seems
to.
It's as if the material, that the subtle material that connects the chakras, those lines,
mm-hmm,
actually, it's. I think that it may be made of yin material. So it's like there's a subtle material that's really yin, that the Ormus is sort of like the building block for that material. That connects in with how they believed in Egypt that we were feeding the subtle body, that we were nurturing the vegetable body.
Uh-huh. The way I think of it is it's sort of like the wire that connects, or the internet connects between different chakras and the energies of the body. Now, is any of this that you've been talking about, does it relate to any of the things that you may have done in past lives or that you may remember having done in past lives?
Oh, yeah, sure, certainly. Of course, you know, when you go back far enough, you find the time when we're in the other forms that which were vegetable body forms. It doesn't seem like we actually evolved from animals. We didn't come from the animal side. We came from vegetable side. That's why our inner makings are vegetable. You know, they're like flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of our subtle body is a flower arrangement instead of an animal arrangement.
Uh-huh. Okay. And that understanding has helped you with what?
It helps me understand how stuff gets reversed. You know, the you know, the how you decide to do something and it gets, while you're doing it, something else happens you don't like?
Mm-hmm.
You know that aspect, right?
Sure.
Where you're going like, oh, damn, I didn't want that.
Right.
You know, that it helps to understand and sort of feel how that's happening, how you're getting the curves in life.
Are you trying to hint at that almost is making you so much more intuitive?
Yeah, it really, really helps. My God. Yeah, exactly. I've noticed, you know, in my psychic training, we were all visual and there was no, you know, listening to people's thoughts or anything. And it's like amazing. I can hear people's thoughts now and it blows me away. It's surprising.
Is it like words or feelings that you're hearing?
Both. And I never ever used to be able to feel what other people were. I couldn't feel where they're at emotionally, but now I sort of hear it's like I'm hearing the gist of it. It's like not that I hear them thinking, but it's sort of like I've heard them. It's sort of like hearing somebody go blah, 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 and then going, I know what that is,
mm-hmm.
You know. They're thinking like this, you know. So, yeah.
Okay. Wow.
So
do you tend to answer people's questions before they finish asking the question?
Yeah, sure.
Does that surprise them?
A lot of times they'll answer the question before they've asked the question, which really often, that surprises them the most. When they get pretty pleased when you're going, well, you know this? And they're going, yeah, well, I was just thinking that. You know this? Yeah?
Wow.
Yeah, Barry's pretty familiar with that particular aspect of consciousness, aren't you, Barry?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It seems a similar thing, doesn't it?
It does indeed.
It happens so often for Barry, he even knew I was going to ask that question.
I suspected.
Right?
So, Miguel, why don't you tell us about the major benefits that Ormus has had for you in your life?
You know, being in Canada is one of the benefits. Years ago, God, like almost 20 years ago, I lost my ability for my body to adjust the temperature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could not stand cold anymore. And it was like maybe 16, 17 years ago that I just decided, screw it, I'm not ever going to live in a cold place ever again. Screw this.
Mm-hmm.
And about 2 years ago, my heat, my body heat came back on. It's like, whoa, I feel good. I didn't have trouble with the 40 below at all. You know, I didn't go out without any clothes, but
uh-huh.
Regular 40 below, just fine, you know.
I've noticed the same thing, yeah. I've never noticed that I noticed it, but now I'm noticing.
Yeah.
I've also noticed that I'm not as sensitive to sunlight. That,
right.
Bright light doesn't, you know, I never feel any urge to wear sunglasses anymore.
Same here.
And I've noticed that I don't sunburn. Nearly as I can't seem to sunburn at all, and my tan never goes away.
Yeah, yeah, I've noticed that it does seem to work like that.
Uh-huh.
I'm hoping. I mean, after looking at this, I would like to start making volcanic water ormus.
Uh-huh.
Because that was what the River Nile had in it, those silts and the ash that was in the mud, the black mud in the water.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And I think that is another one of those things that, you know, that might be really super powerful.
Oh, I know you have to get volcanic volcanic ash mud, basically from Crater Lake, the Crater Lake area, from one of the Ormus providers.
Well, yeah. Huh. That's a good
place to start filling around with it.
Yeah, I'm going to be going through Yellowstone in a couple months, so I'm going to collect a 50-pound sack or something to explore.
Oh, cool, yeah.
I gotta head back down.
Great.
I'll probably get some of the black sand from the volcanic sand from the big lake in the southern end of Yellowstone.
Are you going through Lewiston?
I don't know which towns I'm going through yet. I might be. I haven't planned
to. Sorry, Livingston, Montana.
Yeah, Livingston, Montana.
Because I know somebody that lives in that area who's got some black sand and other things that he might be interested in sharing with you.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Can you email me his contact stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Great. Yeah.
So, is any other questions from anyone else on the call that would like to put to me, who Michael, right now, going once, hit star 7,
yeah,
going twice.
Doug, stop there, Dennis. You've got to take it. This is Bryce from West Australia.
Hi, Bryce.
Hi. I'm just interested in Mahu's memories of the different processes of making Ormus that may be in his memory from past lives. So, yeah, that one.
From, like, Egypt?
Yes, Egypt or other ones, if there's other memories.
Yeah, Egypt is the one that I remember most distinctly. I'm pretty sure that it involved the pyramids, but I'm pretty sure that Egypt was like we'd lost a lot of stuff, as if we weren't developing the technology. We were sort of trying to hang on to it. It's sort of why it got lost, maybe. I think it was all, developed in Atlantis, and then the Ark might even be from Atlantis. But there are there are these crystals that were in the pyramid and may have been used for that exact purpose.
Do you have any memories of Atlantis that might be related?
Yeah, as far as that goes, I believe that the Ormus, the material, was processed with light that came through like emeralds, rubies, like that. Like it was, like somehow I'm not clear on what we were doing, but it passed through light that was in the middle of the pyramid that had these precious stones. I mean, a couple different places talk about the precious stones, and they were, I think they were removed at the end of Atlantis, so it sort of disconnected the connection for making the Ormus, that was really, really powerful.
Uh-huh.
I'm pretty sure that the rulers of Atlantis may have had really long, long, long lives.
Uh-huh.
I think that Zachariah Sitchin might be right about a year being a really long time, like 3,700 years or something, 3,600 years.
Wow.
What they call a pyramid year or a 12th planet year.
Uh-huh.
Because, because of what Richard Hoagland says about the alignment, the alignment with Orion would date the what they're calling the Cheops pyramid, but obviously Cheops had nothing to do with it. It dated it something like 270,000 years.
Wow.
So who is Richard Hoagland, and what's that subject matter consist of?
Richard Hoagland is the Face on Mars guy, and you can see him on the Project Camelot website, and he talks about how Atlantis was really exploring crystals, and I'm pretty much, sometimes when I look at what Ormus is doing inside, it looks as if it's building a sort of a crystalline structure that helps your structure.
How do you look at that?
Oh, clairvoyantly.
Uh-huh. Can you describe that a little bit better?
Well, if you imagine, like, say you look down at your body, or looking at somebody else's body, and you imagine what you sort of go like, as if you're going, you just imagine you can do this. This is pretty much all you do this. You imagine that you see in super 3D video. You're
uh-huh.
just looking at it like you're looking down super 3D video and looking for the subtle structure that's in there.
Uh-huh.
And it's made like out of light, sort of, but underneath the light are all these little lights. And I believe that's how the Ormus is tying together the subtle structure. It's like it's a nutrient. And it's like the substance. It's as if that light needs something to stick to, and what the light likes, it's yin and yang, obviously. It has to have something to hold it, and that's what the oneness is actually a state of matter that holds the light.
Wow.
And so when I look at it, it looks like it's building all this neat crystal stuff in there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Can you tell differences of crystalline structures or shapes or anything like that?
You know, one of the things that has really interested me, this is pretty recent, is that the different noble elements, you know, the different instates,
uh-huh.
I think that the regular metals are not the main thing that is the metal for that fruit chakra. I think it's different noble metals. And I believe, because when I look at the Kundalini as it comes up, it does feel like gold.
Uh-huh.
And so, but the other ones, I would sort of look at the root chakra and go, well, you know, there's some aspect of that feels like lead,
mm-hmm.
but isn't, I forget which, I'm going to have to try to get more, you know, feel this out and meditate on it more and stuff, but I think it is that in the subtle, each one of those vibrations is, and it may be, I would suspect that the light that you find in, like a ruby,
uh-huh.
And I forget what element it is that makes a ruby the color it is, but that may be the element that is in the chakra of that matching color. It's an idea. I'm not absolutely certain of that, but it's kind of an interesting idea.
Have you experimented with crystals or minerals exposing the Ormus you're making or working with to them?
Yeah. I've done that a little bit. I do put my Ormus in pyramids to keep it alive, and it seems to really work. I've noticed that some of the batches that float will float after being in the pyramid. So actually, if I take some Ormus and put it in a pyramid for a couple of weeks,
uh-huh.
and then I take it out and I pour it into another container,
uh-huh.
that Ormus will float.
It will no longer settle out.
Yeah, it will no longer settle out. You know how as your urma sits, it slowly settles with the water on top. Well, under those circumstances, for some reason, it'll settle with the water on the bottom or the water in the middle.
So in other words, have you tried comparing what floats to what sinks in terms of how it feels?
Yeah. The stuff that floats is totally incredible. It's like, yee-hoo! The consistency is different.
Uh-huh.
The floating stuff comes out like pudding.
Uh-huh.
It feels less heavy. It's a lot thicker. It's interesting. Some of it, if it sits there long enough, it'll get more and more dry, as if it's floating up away from the water.
Uh-huh.
Pretty cool.
Could you describe that process from the start? You make the ormus. Does it matter when you make it, astrologically? Does it seem to float just as easily no matter when you make it? Or
No, it does seem that the batches that float are almost always fertile signs. Fertile signs. Either fertile or semi-fertile signs. I've got one that's floating right now. I made a batch of Scorpio, and geez, it is really floated. It's like 80% of the, I've got about a gallon of it, and there's just maybe a cup at the bottom that's not floating in the whole thing.
Wow.
That was Scorpio. And I've noticed that Taurus, I had a Taurus and a Pisces, I've had in the last 4 months or so, I've also had a batch that was the equinox ormus, but I made it a day ahead of the actual equinox because I wanted the Capricorn.
Okay.
What a process, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Capricorn. So, yeah.
So first you would start with a sample that you've done when which planet was in what sign?
Usually, so I make it with the moon, of course. You know, I follow the phases of the moon. And I've got all of them. But I noticed that the ones that are fertile seem to be more apt to float. And the fertile signs are all the water signs or the earth signs.
Okay.
Those are the same ones that, you know, that you use for planting and nuts and so on.
So it's full moon in those signs?
Yeah. Sometimes when I make it, I'll make it like a day ahead of the actual full moon. It depends on what the sign's in. And I look at the aspects to try to make sure there aren't any So I use the moon book, you know, the moon book, Llewellyn's moon book.
Okay.
That gives you all the aspects for each day. It tells you, let's say, if Mars is retrograde, you know, like that. And or if on that day, you know, that sign is square to something, and you sort of want to avoid that.
Sure. Okay, so then once you've made it, settled it, washed it,
right,
then you put it in the pyramid for how long?
For a couple of weeks.
Uh-huh. And this is just a frame pyramid or a pyramid that's just sides or what?
Yeah, it's sides in the bottom.
Uh-huh.
The pyramids I've made out of hardboard.
Okay.
They stand a little over a foot high.
Uh-huh.
You can get a gallon jug into the... It fits a gallon jug just perfectly.
Okay. And you let them sit there for 2 weeks, and then do you open and look, or...?
Yeah. Usually after 2 weeks, I'll siphon off whatever's settled.
Uh-huh.
Or if that's happened. And that's where... That's usually where I'm discovering that it's floating. Or I'll also... I pour it into square containers to dose it out, you know, to put it into bottles. So I've got these gallon of square containers that I pour it into from there.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes it'll float at that point. So sometimes when I'm taking it out of the pyramid, like, oh, look at that.
Yeah.
Right. You know, or sometimes, of course, the Scorpio that just floated, I had 2 gallons of it, and one of them floated when I poured it out, and the other one floated in the pyramid. So, you know, wow. It was like it floated no matter what. Yeah. Yeah.
That's very amazing.
Yeah, I'm at a point where I'm, you know, I've got so much Ormus around me, I'm happy to just consume only Ormus that's floaty Ormus, you know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And how does it feel when you take it?
I like it better. You know, though I don't know that I can describe, I think that I'm able to have more of it. Because since I've been having the floating Ormus, I've upped my dose again.
Okay.
How
does it feel better?
I would say that I don't get as, you know how disoriented sometimes you get if you take a lot of Ormus?
Uh-huh.
You get disoriented and that happens anyway, but it seems to happen less with the floating stuff.
Okay.
And that might even be because of the charge from the pyramid. I'm not sure what is making that go that way, but it feels different to me. It feels more, doesn't feel as heavy, you know, and I tend to be heavy.
Mm-hmm.
My body structure's not heavy. I'm not a fat guy. I'm a, you know, sort of skinny even, but my presence feels heavy to me.
But this makes you feel lighter, but more grounded.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Exactly. Funny, huh?
Okay, that's weird. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I sort of think that's where the evolution of Ormus could go. I mean, it could go that we're really getting into some cool, cool shit. You know?
Yeah, really.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Any other questions?
Yeah, it's Bryce here again.
I have a question.
Another question. It's following on from what you were saying and the use of crystals and how they might enhance the activity of Ormus and the light aspect and your memory of them being used in pyramids. What kinds of places would you put them in pyramids and how would you align them and what kinds of crystals do you think would have very unique energies? Just things like that.
Yeah, you know, I think the trouble is, of course, you can't, you know, I can't afford, you know, rubies and diamonds and cool crap, you know. So probably most of what I'd be doing is like garnet. And, you know, you could take, I've got garnet sandpaper that I've coated with a resin. And you can put that on the outside of your pyramid or underneath the Ormus inside. And that seems to make a difference too. You know about putting crystals in a, you know, encapsulating them like, you know, like Bo's always talking about, right? If you take a crystal and you put it in the middle of something that's going to shrink around it and squeeze the crystal starts vibrating like almost like in a piezoelectric thing, and it gives off a vibration that can be very life-giving. And it appears that that's what the material in, and I'm almost positive this is true, that the material in the pyramids has crystals in it that are encapsulated like that. So and even cement shrinks when it dries up, you know, so you could mix crystals or, you know, you could take a garnet sandpaper and you can put like an epoxy paint over garnet sandpaper. And that epoxy paint will shrink around the little crystals in the sandpaper. And that's probably the cheapest surface of crystal, laminate crystal, they call that. And there's been some good discussions on a couple of people who have played with laminate crystals a lot more than I have. And I've just done a little bit of it. And that's something that I really intend to play with a lot more. And I'm just not sure, you know, I still have to ruminate on it to decide what I'm going to do about it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think there's something to frequencies in crystals. And squeezing them or compressing them and causing them to vibrate is a very interesting thing. Do you do any sound with that situation? Because what crystals would respond to sound as well as light, or?
Yeah, I play for my Ormus, you know. I have my Ormus in these big racks, sort of inside crystals. So I store it. I mean, in pyramids. So I store it in a pyramid, and I play didge for him and stuff like that. So. like it's a person, you know. So you know, yeah, I'm a wacko, but hey, but it really does seem to do something to it. You know?
Well, I don't think that's wacko. I think that's very interesting.
Oh yeah, yeah. I you know, it's okay. I don't mind. I don't mind being a little left of center. So you know, all right. I mean, maybe that's my problem, is that I think I'm left of center when I'm just
apple bubble off.
Yeah. Yep. I'm only missing one cylinder. Yeah. Yeah. Well, one short of a six pack, or. Oh yeah.
Are you ready for another question?
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering if you could talk about, I was off the call for just a little bit. I lost you guys for about 20 minutes, and I don't know if you already answered this question, but when you talked about the fermentation process, was this something that you had remembered from Egypt? And also you had mentioned algae. You seem to remember something of that process, and I wonder if you could elaborate on those two things. Uh-huh.
Yeah. That is one of the things that they talk about of course, shrew bread was made, you know, and there's, people have debated whether it was just like a, you know, giving the Pharaoh and the priests a rock, or was it actually bread? But I don't think that it called it a bread if it wasn't a bread. So it does seem like it. Seems like it, you know, like it, like the fermentation process, and I just remembered that, and you know, and there's been talk of it. The guy wrote that book, you know, about the mana machine, which just the title of the book is all I've got so far, because I went on and looked it up on Amazon, and it was like $120, so have not bought that book yet.
Right.
So
you're saying that you think that the shoe bread could have been a fermented process of grains, possibly put into that conical shape? Do you have any memory of that?
Yeah, almost exactly, yeah.
That's the reason I asked you like that, is almost exactly, is I have a memory of that almost exactly. And when you said that, I was curious if we were having the same memory.
Yeah, I think that it was a baked bread that was like super high ormus. I think it was like a super sour bread, almost like sourdough.
Yeah, that's what I see in my head.
Yeah,
it's like all these grains, fermented in grains or something of that sort.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I suspect.
Have you tried making bread using ormus plus yeast and wheat or whatever?
Yeah, that's another one. I'm still gonna. we don't actually even have an oven here, so until I get back down in the desert, I probably won't do a bread project. But
right.
But that's been my thought. Yeah, I think that it'd be cool if some of us could try that. I suspect that the real sour mashes, like the sourdough type mash, with ormus in it, might be the key to making shoe bread. That it's fermented and that it goes for a while, and that you know that it's probably kind of an art to making it without letting it spoil all the way or something. But you know, I'll bet you. I really think that you're right. I think it would. You know. Yeah. So where are you when you're going to make some of this? I forgot your name already.
Yeah. Where are you?
Me? Oh, this is Melanie. I'm currently in Korea right now, so.
Oh, hi, Melanie.
Hi, Melanie.
Yeah, hi. Well, you know, I got to tell you how this image, the reason I asked you about that is, Vic Verda, I got some of his white powder gold, which he doesn't usually sell, but he sold me a little bit. Like enough for 2 months, and I went off on this 2 month journey of just being completely out there. I mean, I don't know where I was, but I wasn't on this earth. And during that time is when all these sort of, you know, intuitions came to me. And that was when one of them came to me that there was like this different kinds of fermented grains that were actually, could have been the mana or the shoe bread or something. I don't know what the name, but it was a conical, mashed together kind of sprouted grains that had fermented. And actually, I used to work at a raw foods restaurant in San Francisco, and there was this ancient recipe we used to make called Essene bread that was just like that. It was fermented grains. It was kind of disgusting, and I don't think we really had the recipe right. But I have a feeling there's something there, that there is a way to make it much more alchemical.
I used to do that. I used to make... Back in the early 70s, I used to make, called it Jesus Krispies, but it was good. I mean, it was, sprouted wheat bread.
Is this Barry?
Yeah.
Oh, you sound 10 years younger.
I am. I look 10 years younger.
I'm sure you are. I bet you are.
Yeah.
You sound like you're in college.
Well, I just... I'm going to put some pictures up pretty soon of me not having any wrinkles and my younger brothers and sisters all having them.
Yeah, you sound really different. Well, I'm going to experiment. I mean, maybe a few of us might want to experiment, and I'm going to talk to Ron Cusson about it because he and I have been talking a lot about fermenting and ormus, so I'll see what he comes up with. If anybody can, he can come up with something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so that was one question. The other question I wanted to ask you is, you had mentioned you had some memory of algae, and I wonder if you could expound on that.
Yeah, the second arc had something like that in there. It was like something that they brewed. They kept this brew in that they constantly added stuff.
Well, that's what the mono machine talked about, I believe, was algae, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I believe so. Yeah, exactly.
I know that Michael Burberry used to post a bit on making ormus with algae, but I wonder, can we ormusify, I can't make that word correctly, ormusify, our algae? Like, I have spirulina tablets, and I wonder what I can do to those tablets to make them more alchemical.
Yeah, I haven't investigated yet to see if I can take, I've got a bunch of spirulina powder, and I'm thinking of starting with that, but I'm not sure, I mean, it's organic, and it's naturally dried, so I'm not sure if it'll, you know, if it'll brood okay or not.
But didn't you do some yogurt or kefir or something like that?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I make my own sort of an EN product for myself.
Uh-huh.
And I feed it to my animals.
Uh-huh.
I've been brewing it in yogurt for a while.
Uh-huh.
You know what? I forgot. I just started brewing it in yogurt. I did that batch about a month ago, and it accelerated the I've been making the stuff without Ormus in it, and I hadn't even thought of doing it until about a month ago, and I don't know what made me do that. Mm-hmm. But I made a batch, and it went to soft cheese. I mean, like, almost, you know, really quick.
Wow. And you couldn't get it to stay in the yogurt state for very long.
No. It even, you know, usually you put the yogurt in the fridge to make it stop brewing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I put it in the fridge, it just didn't stop brewing. It just kept on brewing. It didn't
that
care.
Is incredible.
Yeah. It's really cool, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to have to make more of it. I have that old cat, and I've been playing with how to dose him on Ormus, and I finally got him pretty good. He almost died a couple months ago, and he used up one of his 9 lives, I think.
Uh-huh.
And then,
yeah.
But I've gotten him back up and going. So
wow.
Yo, this is Phyllis in Arizona. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm with Henry here. And one of the things I've been doing is studying with a naturopathic doctor, and what I learned is that the human body is 90 to 95% commensal cells or bacteria, that there's only 5% or so of the body that are human cells. So it really intrigued me when you said that you had seen that the subtle body was more of a vegetable state than an animal state, because I also studied with Barbara Brennan, so I'm very aware of the subtle body. So it's really curious. And the other thing is that the man who I was studying with, who's a naturopath, was saying that fermented foods feed the commensals. In other words, fermented foods really feed the 95% of our body that is bacterial cells. Now, I don't know what the difference is between the human cells and the bacterial cells. So what you're saying is very, very intriguing to me. So I just would like your comment on all of that.
Yeah, I got my computers. Is this Donna?
It's Phyllis. I'm a friend of Henry's. I'm in Arizona. I took Barry's workshop here twice in Arizona, once in Phoenix, once here in Tucson.
Yeah, cool. I'm not sure. You know, when I look at it, I see it. More on an etheric level, that doesn't, I don't know that, you know, I don't see all of the bacteria like that. But I, you know, maybe sometime looking at it, I don't know.
They had done studies. If you run a Google search on it, you can look at commensal cells, and they have a study, and I forgot where, that 95% of the human cells are bacterial, and the ferments somehow feed bacterial, and I really don't understand the difference between human and bacterial cells in the body.
Yeah, that doesn't make much sense to me either. I don't know why it would be that way. What my own experience of the body is that the body is sort of like some sort of an, as far as the ancient stuff goes, the body has been a problem for us, and our form has always been a problem, but the underlying stuff has been, you know, the problem has been with something else, you know?
Yeah, and it's interesting about gold and the colors and ruby and everything we're talking about, because the subtle body at the highest level old. So if you've got like the, I don't know, 8th chakra show might be gold. And lower levels are the other colors. So with the colors, you're healing different subtle bodies.
Now you're talking about the colors of the different in-state materials or of like gold or ruthenium and rhodium and that sort of?
I was just talking about aura.
Somebody's breathing rather loudly into the microphone.
I'll get further away.
Okay.
I'm you know, most of what I feel is healing is you know, is sort of going through issues of things instead of, I've looked at color healing and I it's just not something that I've done much with. It's sort of not, hasn't really, I mean, with Ormus, I guess that would, I could see doing, help trying it with your Ormus, but I have never tried that. I haven't tried exposing Ormus to different colors and see what it does. But, hey, that's something you can try, Phyllis.
Yeah, I was really curious when you said that the Ormus structure was closer to a vegetable or a flower than an animal form. So what is an animal form like that's different from, say, a plant form? Or were you just talking about, like, the array, what a chakra looks like?
Yeah, the it's the subtle body that is vegetable form. And it used to be that we were just that. We were in a vegetable form back in the land of magic in Eden.
Did we move about in vegetable
form? Oh, yeah, we floated and flew and swam and you know, yeah, we were totally mobile.
And that's
one of the things people imagine is that if we were vegetable form, then we didn't move about, but that wasn't the case.
Is that why we have less chromosomes? We have fewer chromosomes than many animals.
I don't know. I looked at the, when we used to do the medical clairvoyance in my school, we used to look at chromosome stuff, you know, look at the DNA and that sort of stuff. And a lot of times it just looked like a whole lot of damage. So it always seemed as if whenever you tried to correct the DNA that way, it didn't seem to do very much. You know, it just sort of went back as soon as you tried to straighten it out. It's like such a hodgepodge that I don't know that it's, I don't even know what you can do with it other than try to heal your issues in life and get better somehow.
Hmm. Interesting. Thank you.
Sure.
Hi, Mike. It's Richard from Vancouver Island. I got a quick one for you. Would you mind sharing your phone number with me? Because I got about a gazillion questions, some of which are kind of off-topic and et cetera. I think we may have a mutual acquaintance.
Sure.
From years ago.
I'll email you the phone number.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, I will be sending you the people, the names of the email addresses of the people that won the raffle. I think we're probably closing in on time to shut down. I don't know where Dennis doesn't sound
like. Yeah, I'm here.
Are you?
Yep.
And I think it's probably about time to start winding things up, eh?
Yeah, let's do that. Thanks, Mike.
Okay, great.
Good
great.
Call. Appreciate
yes,
it.
Very excellent. Lots of good new information.
Great. It went better than I thought.
Good.
Great. Excellent. Fabulous. Any further questions for me? Just post them on the forums.
I have one question, if that's okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, me here. This is Charles Dragoo from South Carolina. It's a quick question. I just wanted to ask you what method you use to collect your dew, because a little while ago you mentioned that you have a process that you use dew doing the Ormus.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I compress air to get the dew. To get the dew, I take the nighttime air and I compress it, and then I pass it over in strong magnet, and then I direct it down into either salt or a salt bath. Right now I'm using a salt bath, so what I do is I'll take Dead Sea Salt and I'll put it down in the bottom of the bucket, and I'll take a series of bubblers so that I have some way for the air to come out, come out and spread all out in the bucket when I'm doing it.
But the way you explained that, you haven't explained it. I'm not getting any visuals of what you're doing. So would you start again?
Sure. I compress air with a really big, like an aquarium pump, you know, like an air pump of some sort. I'm using an aquarium pump, a pretty big one, and I pass the air, so that's all on the outside, so it is collecting the moisture and all that, and I pass it across a neodymium magnet, a strong magnet, so that like unhinges the ormus that's in the booth.
So you're passing the air line through a magnet.
Right. It's got so the magnet's actually on the outside of the air line.
Okay.
And then
what happens to the air line?
The air line goes down, the air line goes down into a bucket where I have Dead Sea salt and some moisture already. So it's already got, it's like it has to bubble through the salt and liquid. And that really super traps the dew.
Well, that's a pretty interesting technique. I haven't heard that one before. That sounds great.
Yeah, it really works.
Is that like the bubbler that Bo Long has posted about?
Yeah. It's sort of similar to what Bo does.
About alchemy.
And it uses the salt traps the ORMs, of course, because the ORMs are attracted to the salt. And then I just take the salt and do a wet pre-tip. I add the salt to trap water and then make it that way.
Are you suggesting that you then precipitate that? We better wind this up because we're going to get interference and people think that the call is finished and they're still annoying us.
Well, that was an interesting technique, though. I'm glad you mentioned that you make it with trap water, then you bubble it, and then you precipitate it afterwards. Is that right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, great. That sounds awesome.
Very cool. All right, guys, well, thank you very much for being on the call.
Okay,
yeah.
And tell us who you are and where you're from and say goodbye as you go.